Good morning, friends, and welcome to this, the commemorative meeting that we are honoring today of William Quan Judge, philosopher, guide, and friend, who passed from his mortal body on March 21st, 1896. And we will be looking at his life and his effect on us even today in the light of theosophy so that we can understand the cyclical pattern not only of the reincarnation of great souls, but also the passing on of this timeless information, this timeless study that we are so lucky to have today. The meeting will be broken up into three different sections. This first section will be a short biographical sketch of his life. The second section will be a set of four readings that are pertinent to Mr. Judge. And then we will have a lecture after that regarding Mr. Judge's life more in detail and how his effect we are still experiencing today. One of the things that we do have to look at, we want to first read a short quote by Mr. Judge that will kind of get us into this mood of what he has left for us. Arouse in you the meaning of thou art that. Thou art the self. This is the thing to think of in meditation. And if you believe it, then tell others the same. You have read it before, but now try to realize it more and more each day, and you will have the light you want. William Quan Judge was born in Dublin, April 13, 1851. His mother was Alice Mary Quan, his father, Frederick H. Judge. Now, in order to really understand Mr. Judge's life, we just want to put it into the situation of what was going on in the world at that point in time. There was a rise in industrialism worldwide. The United States, during that whole period of time, was experiencing a civil war, as well as the country was expanding rapidly. And of course, we can't forget the rise of spiritualism, which so affected Mr. Judge and how the theosophical movement came out in writing at that point in time so that we can still have it today. And also a great effect personally on the Judge family was the aftermath of the Great Potato Famine, in which we think, although we did not see it, but we wonder if that was the reason why the Judge family came over to the United States. His father was a Mason and a student of mysticism, so we can see that Mr. Judge came into a family that really did support his personality for this lifetime. But unfortunately, we do not know much about his mother except for the fact that she did die in childbirth at the birth of her seventh child. So the senior Mr. Judge, when William was only 13, did bring the family to New York City. July 14, 1864 is when they arrived. And there's not too much about William's young life that we know of, except for the fact that apparently he did die at the age of 7, but rapidly came back to life, but he was a very changed little boy at that point. Physically, he was still very frail and would be affected by this throughout his entire life, but mentally, spiritually, intellectually, he was extremely different. And the changes were very profound. At this point, apparently he was not able to read up until the age of 7, But after this episode that he had, not only was he reading, but he was reading about mesmerism, phrenology, religion, magic, Rosicrucianism, and apparently it is said that he was fascinated by the Book of Revelations. And not only was he frail physically, and then he had this profound intellectual and spiritual emotional change, but he was, what was to last throughout his whole life was that he was very persistent about things. And there's that swimming story that it is told about him, that he was not able to swim, and his friends were taunting him as they swam across to an island in the middle of a river, and that he'd jump down, he'd walk across the bottom of the river, and then he'd jump up and get a breath of air, jump down, and he did this all the way across, and then to come back, and his friends were totally amazed that he was able to do this. So we're seeing that this personality in this life started after this episode he had when he was reawakened. He started his work life out as a clerk. He worked in different jobs as a clerk, then in a law office, and apparently this sparked an interest in him, and he eventually did become a lawyer with a concentration on commercial issues, law issues. But throughout his work life, there was that idea of thoroughness and persistence and industry. At the age of 21, he became naturalized, April of 1872. And then at the age of 23, in 1874, he did marry Ella M. Smith of Brooklyn. And unfortunately, the one and only child that they did have died early in childhood, which apparently affected Mr. Judge quite profoundly, because he did have quite a liking towards children, and apparently the feeling was reversed. Whenever he went into friends' homes, the children always kind of rallied around him. Soon after he was married, he read a book by Colonel Henry Alcott on spiritualism, and this really caught his fancy. And he contacted Colonel Alcott to find out more about it, and Colonel Alcott decided he should meet Madame Blavatsky. And apparently this meeting of the two of them was quite intense, with her saying that it was the reunion of teacher and pupil, and in the future she would call Mr. Judge her only friend. We would like to read Mr. Judge's recollection of this meeting with Madame Blavatsky. "It was her eye that attracted me, the eye of one whom I must have known in lives long passed away. She looked at me in recognition at that first hour, and never since has that look changed. Not as a questioner of philosophies did I come before her, not as one groping in the dark for lights that schools and fanciful theories had obscured, but as one who, wandering many periods through the corridors of life, was seeking the friends who could show where the designs for the work had been hidden. And true to the call, she responded, revealing the plans once again, speaking no words to explain, simply pointed them out and went on with the task. It was as if the evening before we had parted, leaving yet to be done some detail of a task taken up with one common end. It was teacher and pupil, elder brother and younger, both bent on the one single end, but she with the power and the knowledge that belongs but to lions and sages. So, friends, from the first, I felt safe." So, while he was in New York, he was studying with H.P.B. and apparently was giving her some assistance on Isis Unveiled. During this period of time, Mr. Judge, HPB, and Colonel Alcott kind of proposed the idea in September of 75 to actually form a group to study the theosophical ideas. So on November 7th, 1875, the three of the co-founders did actually form the Theosophical Society. After that point, Mr. Judge does go to South America, where he contracts the Chagas fever, which will plague him from this until he dies. In 1878, Colonel Alcott and HPB go to India after Isis Unveiled was published, leaving the 27-year-old William back in the United States to carry on the work of formulating the Theosophical Society in the United States. In 1884, he travels to Europe with HPB, but then returns to the U.S. to work in earnest to try and build up the society. And during this whole time, just like when he started working, he was noted, his reputation increased greatly because he was noted for his dedication and his perseverance to the Theosophical Society. As HPB put it, that he was a disciple under trial, and that, quote, his ego had reincarnated several times immediately after death in order to further this work. And he established in 1885 the American section with all the branches independently devoted to the cause. And when HPB died in 1891, the interest in Theosophical Society did decrease. And he is known as the resuscitator of Theosophy in America because he just was persistent, and at times he would even hold meetings to keep it in the cycle. If he was the only one, he would still open it up, have a lecture, and because it was so important to keep the cycle going of these meetings, and he would do it even if he was the only one. He lectured, he wrote continuously, all this while working as a lawyer, but eventually he did give up his profession so that he could work totally and dedicate his entire life to the work of Theosophy. So just some of his short little phrases that he liked. He was often to say, forgive, forgive, and largely forget. Cast no one out of your life. And he was of the type that if, even though he was working on a certain thing and had certain ideas in his mind, he was not pompous to the point where somebody would say, you know, Mr. Judge, why don't we try this? And if he felt as though it was a good idea, then he was not proud to the point where he wouldn't take somebody else's ideas. But he was so dedicated to the work that it is said that, especially when he wasn't feeling well, that if somebody would suggest to him, well, why don't you let me do this, he would say, yes, thank you, but then he would go and do some other work for the philosophy. His only aim was to further the cause of Theosophy. And he wrote, we'll just list some of his writings. He wrote The Path. He started that in April of 86. He wrote The Ocean of Theosophy, his letters, Echoes of the Orient, The Epitome of Theosophy. The Gita translation that we have from Sanskrit is, from our understanding, is supposed to be one of the best Sanskrit translations that there is. He wrote the first seven chapters of the Gita Notes, with Mr. Crosby finishing it. And of course, the voluminous articles that we are so lucky to have out there of his. And he died March 21st, 1896, and he was almost 45 at that point. it was interesting that when he died, when the doctors examined him after death, they said that his lungs were fine and his heart was fine. And it is said that he just felt as though it was time for him to go. So he left his mortal body at that point. And we would just like to read a last message to us from him. There should be calmness, hold fast, go slow. And if you take down those words and remember them, you will find that they contain an epitome of his whole life struggle. He believed in theosophy and lived it. He believed because he knew that the great self of which he so often spoke was the eternal self, was himself. Therefore, he was always calm. He held fast with unwavering tenacity to his purpose and to his ideal. He went slow and never allowed himself to act hastily. He made time his own, and he was justice itself on that account. And he had the power to act with the rapidity of lightning when the time for action came.
The signs of this cycle. Men of all nations for many years in all parts of the world have been expecting something they know not what, but of a grave nature to happen in the affairs of the world. The dogmatic and literal Christians, following the vague prophecies of Daniel, look every few years for their millennium. This has not come, though predicted for almost every even year, and especially for such as 1,000, 1,500, 1,600, 1,700, 1,800, and now for the year 2000. But the theosophical notions about the matter are based on something more definite than a vague Jewish priest's vaticinations. We believe in cycles and in their sway over the affairs of men. The cyclic law, we think, has been inquired into and observations recorded by the ancients during many ages. And arguing from daily experience, where cycles are seen to recur over and over again, believing also in reincarnation as the absolute law of life, we feel somewhat sure of our ground. This cycle is known as the Dark One. In Sanskrit, Kali Yuga, or the Black Age. It is dark because spirituality is almost obscured by materiality and pure intellectualism. Revolving in the depths of material things and governed chiefly by the mind, apart from spirit, its characteristic gain is physical and material progress. Its distinguishing loss is in spirituality. In this sense, it is the Kali Yuga. For the theosophist in all ages has regarded loss of spirituality as equal to the state of death or darkness, and mere material progress in itself is not a sign of real advancement, but may have in it the elements for its own stoppage and destruction. Preeminently, this age has all these characteristics in the Western civilizations. We have very great progress to note in conquests of nature, in mechanical arts, in the ability to pander to love of luxury, in immense advancements with wonderful precision and power in the weapons made for destroying life. But side by side with these, we have wretchedness, squalor, discontent, and crime. Very great wealth in the hands of the few, and very grinding poverty overcoming the many. As intellectualism is the ruler over this progress of material things, we must next consider the common people, so-called, who have escaped from the change, from the chains which bound them so long. They are not exempt from the general law, and hence, having been freed, they feel more keenly the grinding of the chains of circumstance. And therefore, the next characteristic of the cycle among human beings is unrest. The second prophecy is nearer our day and may be interesting. It is based upon cyclic changes. This is a period of such change. This glorious country, free as it is, will not long be calm. Unrest is the word for this cycle. The people will rise. For what? Who can tell? The statesman who can see for what the uprising will be might take measures to counteract, but all your measures cannot turn back the iron wheel of fate. Let those whose ears can hear the whispers and the noise of the gathering clouds of the future take notice. Let them read, if they know how, the physiognomy of the United States, whereon the mighty hand of nature has traced the furrows to indicate the character of the moral storms that will pursue their course, no matter what the legislation may be. We are not dealing with the rights or the wrongs of either side in these struggles, but only referring to the facts. They are some of the moral signs of our cycle, and they go to prove the prognostications of the Theosophist about the moral, mental, and physical unrest. The cycle is closing, and everywhere unrest will prevail. As lands will disappear or be changed, so in like manner ideas will alter among men. And as our civilization is based on force and devoid of a true philosophical basis, the newest race in America will more quickly than any other show the effect of false teachings and corrupted religion. But out of anger and disturbance will arise a new and better time, yet not without pain, which accompanies every new birth.
This reading is from the notes on the Bhagavad Gita. All of us are brought to this study by our own request made to our higher self, who is Krishna. It does not matter whether he now is consciously aware of having made the request, nor whether it was made as a specific act in this life or in many another precedent one. It was made, and it is to be answered at the right time. Some of us have asked this many times before in ancient births of ours in other bodies and other lands. Others are making the request now, but it is more than likely in the case of those who are spurred on to intense effort and longing to know the truth and to strive for unity with God, that they have put up the petition ages since. We take up the gauge over and over, life after life, in experience after experience, never completely defeated if we always look to Krishna, our higher self. All the passing shows of life, whether fraught with disaster or full of fame and glory, are teachers. He who neglects them neglects opportunities which seldom the gods repeat. And the only way to learn from them is through the heart's resignation. For when we become in heart completely poor, we at once are the treasurers and dispersers of enormous riches. The attitude to be assumed then is that of doing every act, small or great, trifling or important, because it is before us to do, and as a mere carrying out by us, as instruments of the will of that deity who is ourself. This practice is the highest, that which someday we must and will learn to perform. Effacement in the Supreme Spirit is gained by the right-seeing sage whose sins are exhausted, who hath cut asunder all doubts, whose senses and organs are under control, and who is devoted to the well-being of all creatures. If the last qualification is absent, then he is not a right-seeing sage and cannot reach union with the Supreme. It must follow that the humblest imitator, everyone who desires to come to that condition, must try to the best of his ability to imitate the sage who has succeeded. And such is the word of the Master. For he says in many places that if we expect to have his help, we must apply ourselves to the work of helping humanity to the extent of our ability. No more than this is demanded. Krishna says that those who, with the eye of spiritual wisdom, see that the self is all, begin to reincarnate with that belief ingrained in them. Hitherto, they had come back to earth without that single idea, but possessed of many desires and of ideas which separated them from the self. Now they begin to return fully at rest in the self and working out their long accumulated karma. And at last they become a Mahatma, or great soul.
Western occultism. When our own internal determination is to know the truth for the sake of truth, we have taken a step. It signifies for each one that his own real self is, by his trend of thought, finding a channel for expression. This will grow. Do not let the conditions which surround you, contrasted with that which you see, weigh upon you. All that is necessary is for each one to do his duty by every duty. None is small and unimportant. Duty is not what other people think we ought to do. Duty is what we ourselves see to do. To fulfill that is the great hope. Attachment to things or results comes by thinking about them. We can have no attachment for a thing we don't think about, nor any like or dislike. While doing the best we know by every act and present duty. We need not attach ourselves to any particular form of result. Leave result to the law. They will surely come to accommodate with it. Having done our duty as we see it, we should not resign all personal interest in results. Whatever the results, each can take them as that which his true self desired. It is motive alone that marks the line between black and white. But what is needed in the world is knowledge. Good motive may have moral character, but it does not ensure those thoughts and acts which make for the highest good of humanity. Theosophy is the path of knowledge. It was given out in order, among other things, that good motive and wisdom might go hand in hand. If it is remembered that the purpose of life is to learn, and that life is all made up of learning, the ordinary duties of everyday existence are seen to be the means by which we learn many things. A mental bias cannot be changed even by one so wise and powerful as a master. If the one in error cannot see his fault, nothing can be done. Another life is in a humbler station. The lesson may be learned. As I understand it, masters cannot interfere with karma. It is not what we go through that counts. It is what we learn from it. No one can know anything for another. Each has to know for himself. No vicarious atonement, no vicarious transmission of knowledge is possible. But the direction in which knowledge lies may be pointed out. The steps which will lead us in that direction may be shown. That only can be done by those who have passed that way before. It is exactly what is being done.
The way of inward peace is in all things to conform to the pleasure and disposition of the divine will. Such as would have all things succeed and come to pass according to their own fancy are not come to know this way, and therefore lead a harsh and a bitter life, always restless and out of humor, without treading the way of peace. Know then, O man, that he who seeks the hidden way can only find it through the door of life. If the hearts of all at some time, in the hearts of all at some time, there arises the desire for knowledge. He who thinks his desire will be fulfilled, as the little bird in the nest, who has only to open his mouth to be fed, will very truly be disappointed. In all nature we find no instance where effort of some kind is not required. We find there is a natural result from such effort. He who would live the life or find wisdom can only do so by continued effort. If one becomes a student and learns to look partially within the veil, or has found within his own being something that is greater than his outer self, it gives no authority for one to sit down in idleness or fence himself in from contact with the world. Because one sees the gleam of the light ahead, he cannot say to his fellow, I am holier than thou, or draw the mantle of seclusion around himself. The soul develops like a flower in God's sunlight and unconsciously to the soil in which it grows. Shut out the light and the soil grows damp and sterile. The flower withers or grows pale and sickly. Each and every one is here for a good and wise reason. If we find partially the why we are here, then is there the more reason that we should, by intelligent contact with life, seek in the further elucidation of the problem. It is not the study of ourselves so much as the thought for others that opens the door. The events of life and their causes lead to knowledge. They must be studied when they are manifested in daily life. There is no idleness for the mystic. He finds his daily life among the roughest and hardest of the labors and trials of the world, perhaps, but goes his way with smiling face and joyful heart, nor grows too sensitive for association with his fellows, nor so extremely spiritual as to forget that some other body is perhaps hungering for food. It was said by one who pretended to teach the mysteries, it is needful that I have a pleasant location and beautiful surroundings. He who is a true theosophist will wait for nothing of the sort, either before teaching or what is first needful, learning. It would perhaps be agreeable. But if the divine inspiration comes only under those conditions, then indeed is the divine afar from most of us. He only can be a factor for good or teach how to approach the way who, forgetting his own surroundings, strives to beautify and illumine those of others. The effort must be for the good of others, not the gratifying of our own senses or love for the agreeable or pleasant. Giving thought to self will most truly prevent and overthrow your aims and objects, particularly when directed toward the occult. Again, there arises the thought, I am a student, a holder of a portion of the mystic lore. Insidiously, there steals in the thought, behold, I am a little more holier than other men who have not penetrated so far. Know, O man, that you are not as great even as they. He who thinks he is wise is among the most ignorant of men, and he who begins to believe he is wise is in greater danger than any other man who lives. You think, O man, that because you have attained a portion of occult knowledge, that it entitles you to withdraw from contact with the rest of mankind. It is not so. If you have obtained true knowledge, it forces you to meet all men not only halfway, but more than that, to seek them out. It urges you not to retire, but, seeking contact, to plunge into the misery and sorrow of the world. And with your cheering word, if you have no more, the mystic has little else, to strive to lighten the burden for some struggling soul. You dream of fame. We know no such thing as fame. He who seeks the upward path finds that all is truth, that evil is the good gone astray. Why should we ask for fame? It is only the commendation of those we strive to help. Desire neither notice, fame, nor wealth. Unknown, you are in retirement. Being fameless, you are undisturbed in your seclusion. and can walk the broad face of the earth, fulfilling your duty as commanded, unrecognized. If the duty grows hard, or you faint by the way, be not discouraged, fearful, or weary of the world. Remember that thou mayest look for silence in the tumult, solitude in company, light in darkness, forgetfulness in pressures, vigor in despondency, courage in fear, resistance in temptation, peace in war, and quiet in tribulation. Work as those who are ambitious. Respect life as those who desire it. Be happy as those who live for happiness.
We hope that those readings that we have just heard could sort of give us a feeling of what and who William Q. Judge was, the philosopher, the guide, and the friend. We try to understand, we try to take what we can from the philosophy, we try to put it into our daily lives, as so Mr. Judge did. And we can all be aware that there are beings who come into the world from time to time with no mark or marks of any distinction, that we, as, quote, human beings, can recognize. But possessors of a knowledge which we ardently desire to possess, they are never recognized save by the few, while they are among us. But when they go, that which they have given tells us what they were. So of all the great books, of all the articles, of all his talks and lectures, William Q. Judge was what people have said was a soul with a mission. And we see a clear outline of that effort, a thread of an intention. We understand what the goals were and the thoughts were for anyone listening to any of these or reading any of his writings. One gets a feeling that each one has to be their own judge of what is true and what is not true. Not to just take it from the ear, take it from the readings of a book and say, this is mine. We have to make it ours. We have to test it ourselves. What he knew and what he wrote and how he wrote it, expressed it, and how behaved towards all was very important. Friends or enemy alike, it states. He was not one who was to give out quotes easily. He was not one to force his ideas or thoughts on anyone. And what is so true, when we look at his teachings, he taught in ideals and ideas to carry, not dogmatic, do this, do that, but giving us something that we could sink our teeth into and check and try to verify for ourselves. His method is suggestive rather than dogmatic. He emphasized his words and deeds on the age-old ideas. That was the basic idea. Always he pointed to the teachings. He expressed and maintained loyalty, fidelity to the teacher, HPB, who brought forth the teachings of the East to the West. And he sort of sought to kindle that soul fire in the minds and hearts of those who came to him, to awaken them to their possibilities, all that we too can accomplish, not his accomplishments. He was good for this Western culture and Western civilization, as was brought out in the readings of the way that he proceeded to emphasize the teachings and to have us recognize the significance of it, was very much for that, the Western culture, to be able to pick it up and understand it. And yet he expressed a true wisdom of the spiritual condition of man, which was his aim and his destiny. So when we look at this idea about what can we say about the philosopher, the guide, the friend, unknown to the students of William Q. Judge? Well, this idea of a philosopher, he showed a sensible calm and regulated his life by the light of theosophy. His patience, his fortitude, shows in his living of the highest moral ethics. To the students, it is said, one who knows how to be restrained, liberal, and merciful can bring death to selfishness. Mm-hmm. We see that in his daily work with individuals, students, and commentators alike. That idea to wish to know is almost solely intellectual, and the desire to be of the heart. That was an example of William Q. Judge. And as he states, and as we heard earlier, no effort, even the smallest, and even in vain, knowing this, each one can try and keep on trying. Do every act, as he stated, small or great, trifling or important, because it's before us to do. That is the basic reason. And to show the way and to indicate a path, we can say, is an idea of how he was a guide. With his words of wisdom, shows one how to move on a certain path by advice and counseling on ideas and facts, just as he himself lived. And that idea of meditating on the higher self can be difficult. If that's too difficult for one, he used to say, seek the bridge, the masters. So if we can understand great sages and great masters of wisdom, we can think about those individuals and how they express themselves and their interaction with people. He also gave us hints when it came to guides about the ideas of how we refrain and how we not refrain and how we interact with individuals. When he brings up that duty of another, every time we think that someone else has done wrong, we should ask ourselves two questions. Am I the judge in this matter who is entitled to try this person? And am I any better in my way? Do I or do I not offend in some others or in some other way just as much as they seem to do in this? He comes with the idea, he says, think this will settle the matter? Let it go. Just let it go. And that statement that was mentioned earlier of his that is well known, the idea there should be calmness and hold fast and go slow. This is the procedure one can take as learning. Nothing around us happens overnight. Nothing in nature, nothing in the universe, nothing in our growth and understanding happens overnight. But the fact that we have that gumption to get up and keep trying, taking it slow, and holding fast to what we really believe makes the difference. Now let's look at the idea of the friend. It says, he was a most sympathetic companion and gave assistance in kind and a helpful manner. He encouraged one to go on, to trust in the law of karma. Endeavor to do that which is right from the standpoint of your inner consciousness, and you will be led in the right way. Too often, he tried to explain, we don't take the time to listen to that voice of silence within us, that part of our nature that knows what is balance, what is harmony. Then some of his ideas were expressed, and most individuals always took it to hand and would think about it later. And it just says, take courage and be patient. The light is shining in your heart, and if you will but go on, you will find it there, and it will be brighter far than you can now imagine. So again, he gave us hope to move on. He gave us a reason to move on. There's a lot of information from his book, Letters, that have helped me. We have often heard it said from older students, and as we became students, we all can remember. They say just, you know, take the book and open it up. Just let it open up. And whatever on that page can be a help to you, can be an answer to you, because he seemed to know exactly what we were going through at that moment. He knew just what was suffering right now. And yet while he described our present condition so perfectly that we know he must have experienced it himself, and he is capable of detaching from the emotion, that emotion, that problem, to offer us the clue to solve it. That says to us, he was where I am now. He got beyond it, and he is encouraging me to go on, to fight as a soul. So in a way, he was truly a compass with his needle always pointing another to correct direction for soul living. And that idea of devoting service to humanity. Other statements that come to mind from the letters, let those who are the strongest show the road to those who are weaker, and to help them climb the steep hill of life. There are many, many examples from his letters that all should take advantage of, because they do make us understand. Try to take pleasure in doing what is your duty, and especially in the little duties of life. Solidify your character By attending to the small things, the bigger ones will take care of themselves. Do not judge in anger, for though the anger passes, the judgment remains. All this goes through this, and there are so many others from his letters that give us an idea, and it states, all our devotion to Aryan literature and philosophy arises from a belief that millions of minds who have taken weary steps before ours left a path which might be followed with profit and yet with discrimination. Mr. Judge tells us the final authority is in man himself. So for us to just get an idea of a philosopher and a guide and a friend, to be able to have these writings, to be able to touch upon them at any time we need that little push, that little help, they say, just open the book and let it fall open to whatever the page is and start reading. That'll be your little push to understanding why the importance of expressing as much of your life as you can in an altruistic way, one-on-one. So hopefully the readings that we had this morning have given us some sort of little hints to think about, to understand, and in a way show our devotion and gratefulness that we are able in today's world to have these writings available to us, to be able to read them over and over and study them and then try to practice some of his ideas that he expressed that were universal, to make us understand that in truth we will be our own authority. So that is what we have planned for today. And we understand that all over the world they have had this type of meeting and people have joined in. So we are going to close this part. And for those of you who wish to stand around and stay around for a few minutes and show some fellowship, please feel free on this day of William Q. Judge. Thank you. Yeah, those, just leave them at the desk.
He's got them now.
He's good. Now, what do we turn off? Yeah.